Hey friends, I hope you're well. Jumping in here to make a little announcement. Actually, it's kind of a big announcement for me, at least. Listen, after spending like a decade, basically, doing this podcast, interviewing authors, musicians, leaders, I have finally written something of my own. I'm really excited about it. This has been a long time coming. It's a long story, and I'll go into that story in detail at some later time, but today I'll just say my book is out. It was co-authored with John Perkins. Many of you probably know who he is, a pastor, civil rights leader. He has an amazing story. If you haven't, go out and grab his books, especially the ones that are more of a memoir. Let Justice Roll Down is probably his first one, and then he's had some after that. They're phenomenal. I had the supreme honor of co-writing this book with him. It's called Go and Do, and you can check it out now. You can get it on Amazon or wherever books are sold, but I will tell you that you can get it for 40% off if you go to my website and go to the tab that says, what does it say? The tab that says discount code. So if you go to shaneblackshear.com/discount-code, it will take you to a place where you can put your email in, sign up, and you will automatically get an email with a coupon code for 40% off. So definitely save that money and go purchase there. If not, like I said, you can, if you want to pay full price, go to Amazon. I won't see any more of that money, so it's fine with me either way. I'd rather you get the discount. So please do that. Like I said, I will be sharing more about this book when the time comes, but for now, it's out, it's there, and I would be honored if you would read it. Okay, here's the show.
Hi, I'm Deb.
This is Frankie V.
I'm Grant.
Hi, this is Phil.
I'm Aaron.
I'm Steven.
Hi, I'm Joe.
Hi, I'm Matt.
We're Tim and Terry.
I'm Susan.
Hi, this is Phil.
Seminary Dropout is supported by listeners like you and me.
Seminary Dropout is supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did.
It's easy.
It's easy.
Just visit supportseminarydropout.com.
Just go to supportseminarydropout.com.
And I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. Interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers. Let's go. My guest, Michael Bird, is academic dean and lecturer in theology at Ridley College in Melbourne, Australia. He's the author of more than a dozen books, including What Christians Ought to Believe and Evangelical Theology. He also runs a popular theological studies blog called Evangelon and can be followed on Twitter at mbird12. Mike, thanks for being back on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me, Shane.
So the new book is called Seven Things I Wish Christians Knew About the Bible. I really felt like you write a lot of things, and most are for the academic sphere. This is, you know, is not, although academics would enjoy it. It felt like you were really kind of responding to something that was going on in the zeitgeist at the time by writing this book.
Yeah, I mean, I do write a lot of, you know, academic-y books for, you know, other scholars or researchers or postgrad students. Every now and then it's nice to write a book that someone actually reads. And this is one of those books, you know, dealing with the sort of questions, concerns, doubts, curiosities that many Christians have about the Bible, where it came from, how it matters, why it matters, and how best to handle it.
Well, let's dig in a little bit. You start off with the Old Testament. I had never given much thought to how the Old Testament came to be. I kind of feel like as Christians, we kind of have a shortcut because Jesus seems to rely on the Old Testament. Like, he kind of seems to think it's authoritative. And so, you know, if we can believe in Jesus, that's kind of our shortcut there. I'm curious how the Old Testament came to be. And then I'm also curious to know, was the Old Testament, as we have it, at least the same books, is this the Bible that Jesus had and read?
Yeah, a few questions there. Yeah, Christians largely inherited the Old Testament from their Jewish context. So, you know, Jesus and the apostles were all Jews. They were thoroughly embedded and part of the religious tradition of ancient Judaism. and the Jewish people. And the Jews had their own scriptures, which we call the Hebrew Bible. Although I should say for the early church, particularly once you get out of Judea and Palestine into the more wider Mediterranean environment of Greece, Asia Minor, and those sorts of places, the Christians are tending to use the Old Testament in its Greek translation, what we call the Septuagint. Okay, a long story behind that. So they seem to have used the Old Testament, but mainly in the Greek version, in which it was circulating amongst Greek-speaking Jewish communities. So that's kind of like where they inherited that from. Is the Bible that we have the same as what the ancient or what the Jewish people had? I can give a qualified yes to that. Yeah, pretty much in terms of the actual books themselves. Yeah, I mean, we can be we know which books Jews were reading, and we have those books as well. The Greek version of the Old Testament was a little bit wider. That had a few extra books in it, like the Wisdom of Solomon, sometimes the Psalms of Solomon, and a few extra books that probably didn't ever exist in Hebrew, but were original Greek compositions by Jewish authors themselves. So you could get a few things like that. But for the most part, yeah, there's this continuity. And then you get terms of textual form, again, you give a qualified yes. If you compare the Isaiah scroll found in the Dead Sea Scrolls with our version of Isaiah today, you find that they're pretty much near similar. There'll be one a few variations here and there, as you do when you compare any two manuscripts or any two textual traditions. But in terms of what the book of Isaiah that ancient Jews and ancient Christians were reading and what we have it today, yeah, it is the same.
You mentioned the Dead Sea Scrolls, and I've heard that about Isaiah that's pretty much the same. I've also heard that, like, is it Esther that's not in the Dead Sea Scrolls at all? Am I getting that right?
Yeah, it's Esther is the one that's not in the Dead Sea Scrolls. I mean, some of the later rabbis had questions about Esther because it's the one book of the Bible that doesn't mention God.
Right, right.
It's something of a sort of a romantic novella about the lead heroine, Esther. So some people did have questions. Some of the rabbis, you know, wondered, you know, why is this in our Bible, kind of a thing. But it's, you know, it's the story of God's people persevering under a kind of, you know, pagan ruler, and how things turn out well for them in the end, which more or less seems to be the story of the Jews across history. For the most part, they always seem to survive in the end. It's the great threaded resilience of the Jewish people.
Okay, so let's move on to the New Testament. You don't spend too much time talking about the Gospels and Acts. Who do you think wrote the Gospels? How about that? Where do you stand on that?
Oh, well, I mean, for each gospel, it's different. I mean, strictly speaking, the gospels are anonymous. They don't actually tell us who the authors were. And the titles, like Gospel According to Mark, Luke, Matthew, John, were probably added, I think fairly early on, but on the basis of local tradition. I don't think the authors themselves wrote, are now writing, you know, Gospel According to Mark, because it kind of assumes that there's another gospel out there to distinguish them. The Gospel of Mark is associated with a figure called John Mark, who was a one-time traveling companion of Paul, and according to tradition ended up in Rome as something of Peter's interpreter. And then in later tradition, he in fact becomes the first bishop of Alexandria in Egypt. I mean, he's a good candidate as any. I mean, there were a lot of Marks in the ancient world and the early church, but the Gospel of Mark does seem to give, I would say, a Pauline theological perspective, big focus on the cross, a lot of, you know, big use of the word gospel, could be a bit of Pauline influence there, but Peter is definitely the most prominent disciple. So you could argue the Gospel of Mark is Pauline theology and Petrine memory that have been forged together. The Gospel According to Matthew, which was the most popular gospel of the early church, the most popular book in the early church. It was the everyone loves Raymond of the of early Christianity. Everyone loved the Gospel of Matthew. It was the number one bestseller. It was the Michelle Obama biography, if you like, for the ancient world. Everyone loved it. It was on the New York Times bestseller list all the time. Again, that's indebted, that's attributed to the tax collector, you know, Matthew. However, the fact that it seems to be reliant on Mark would suggest that maybe it was not written by a specific eyewitness like Matthew. So maybe it was kind of either dedicated to Matthew, or it was written by someone who was part of Matthew's circle, or part of the sort of social network that Matthew was a part of, and the sort of Christianity that Matthew helped influence and create has then shaped this sort of retelling of Mark's gospel. Then we have the Gospel of Luke, which seems to be written by what is clearly a second or third generation Christian, definitely dependent on Mark as well, maybe dependent on Matthew, or maybe Matthew and Luke share a common source together. That's another question. But it's written by someone who also appears to be a Pauline traveling companion, but who writes in a slightly more elegant or educated style of Greek, and seems to be a little bit more au fait with ancient literary form. So writes a somewhat more polished version of the story of Jesus and the beginnings of the early church. Then we get to the Gospel of John. This is again, a complicating issue. We can just say, oh, well, it was written by John, the son of Zebedee, one of the original disciples. Or the Gospel's testimony is indebted to a figure enigmatically called the beloved disciple, who doesn't really appear on the scene until John 13, where Jesus is reclining, it was the disciple whom he loved kind of reclined against his bosom or chest, or was it vice versa? I can't remember. And he seems to be the one who provides the testimony on which the gospel is based. Now, whether he's the guy who actually wrote the gospel is another question. And we know for certain that this book was definitely added. There's a strong chance that chapter 21 is a kind of later addition, trying to make sense. Well, the beloved disciple died and everyone just assumed that he was going to live until the time of Jesus. And it kind of clarifies, well, no, that's not actually what Jesus told him at all. And then it kind of finishes with the words, this is the one who tells the story, and we believe his testimony is true. So you've got the second person plural. So in the very end of the book, you've got that plural perspective, which means there are people who are reflecting on the testimony of the beloved disciple. Now, you could say that's John, the son of Zebedee. Some people think it's a different John, someone called John the Elder, who seems to be known in the early church. We've got letters by John the Elder, and Papias mentions two prominent disciples, John and an Aristian. So yeah, it's a little bit enigmatic. I guess we can just keep singing the song, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John went to bed with the stockings on. That's all good enough as it is. But that's, in a nutshell, the story of the authorship of the four Gospels as generally they're handled in scholarship.
That's really good to know. So I'm curious, is that, Richard Bauckham and Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, is that essentially what he lays out? Or does Bauckham think it's a... The connection is a little bit closer, that there's not so much distance between the authors and whoever walked around with Jesus?
Well, no, he believes that eyewitnesses were very important and prevalent and had a kind of conserving effect upon the tradition. And I think he demonstrates that very ably in certain ways, particularly in the Gospel of Mark, where I think he does a good job saying that the Gospel of Mark is really based on Petrine testimony. I mean, Peter is the first and the last disciple mentioned. He keeps popping up at all these major points, the calling of the disciples, the confession of Jesus as the Messiah, Jesus' death. It's definitely told, you could say, through Peter's eyes in a lot of ways. Bauckham's good on that. Again, in the fourth gospel, the Gospel of John, Bauckham does a good job in showing that the beloved disciple seems to be the eyewitness behind the fourth gospel. So he does a really good job of narrating that. But that doesn't really solve the authorship questions about these gospels. I think Bauckham would argue that the Gospel of John was also written by John the Elder, maybe the beloved disciple is John the Elder. I mean, we don't know how close to conflate these characters. But yeah, he'd be along there. I think he'd pretty much agree with what I just sort of laid out there.
So I think this is really important because a lot of times, especially like on social media, you have people who are saying like the Gospels were written like hundreds of years after Jesus. And even sometimes you get the idea that the oral tradition was like, happened for generations before they actually wrote this down. And I mean, Mark 70 AD, that's really close to Jesus's life chronologically. It's close to Jesus's life and death. There should be plenty of people around to you know, get the story straight.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. On those two issues, I mean, first of all, the Gospels were not written centuries later. They were written within one lifetime, within a few decades of Jesus's life, or at least you could say 40 to 50, certainly within 50 years, I think, or so of his death. But by people or resource from people who were still very much alive during that time. And yeah, I mean, this is not abnormal in antiquity. You can have people writing events about events, you know, decades later to preserve them for posterity because they want to defend a certain person or a certain group. So this is pretty much standard in ancient history writing. In terms of the sort of the oral tradition underlying the gospel, well, there's two things to go. I mean, there's two problems. Some people can romanticize oral tradition as if everyone had basically memorized every word Jesus had ever said and then transmitted it on. So I don't think that's quite what happened either. But at the same time, we shouldn't think that the oral tradition was kind of like a game of Chinese whispers, which starts out with, you know, send reinforcements, we're going to advance, and, you know, five persons later becomes send three and sixpence, we're going to advance. I don't think it was quite that loose and fluid. But the Gospels were written to provide a kind of literary deposit for the story of Jesus, the teaching of Jesus for the next generation, given that many of the early apostles, the early followers, and the first generation was passing away. So it was there to create a further literary testimony to Jesus as the first generation was disappearing.
Chinese whispers, is that what you guys call that in Australia?
Yeah.
It's okay. We call it telephone here, a game of telephone.
Okay.
But yeah, that metaphor is exactly what I was thinking about. We think it's this game of telephone where it's like, you know, it passes through like 30 people and the message is completely different at the end. So I like it. So let's talk about Paul and Paul's letters and pseudonymity. You know, I was talking with Nijay Gupta not long ago, and we were talking about his most recent book on the New Testament. And I was saying, you know, I feel like the more people I talk to, the more it seems like the ideas come back into favor that at least there's a strong possibility that Paul wrote all of the letters attributed to Paul. Where are you on that?
Well, it depends who you ask. You know, I tend to think that Paul wrote the letters attributed to him. Here's the thing people have to remember is what does it mean to say Paul wrote a letter? Let me give you like what I think three examples, okay, of how I think this is. We need to have a flexible understanding of writing. I think Paul wrote to Philemon, and I think Paul himself had his pen, ink or wherever he was. I think he actually sketched it down or was literally dictating it to someone who was writing. Okay, so I think Paul wrote it. When it comes to the letter to the Colossians, I think that this is a letter from Paul, but it's written largely in collaboration with someone like Timothy, and they're responding to a lot of, you know, reports they've heard about Colossae from, you know, Epaphras, about Archippus and the situation there. And you know, it's written kind of like in collaboration with Tim. And Timothy maybe could be like the lead author, but you know, Paul's in, I mean, you have to remember Paul's in prison, and he's not kind of like a French aristocrat sitting in some little miniature office that he's created inside this sort of, you know, prison. He's writing in fairly derelict conditions. So he's getting this letter written, you know, he's talking to Timothy what they need to say, that type of thing. And then I think once that is written, they said, look, this is good. We should send something to the churches, you know, that we know of in the local area in like in Asia Minor, Western Turkey, you might say. And on the basis of that, Paul and the team, or probably mostly the team, then write Ephesians. Okay. So this is what I would say the three different levels of authorship. Paul actually writes Philemon. He writes Colossians in collaboration, Timothy, maybe with Timothy taking a leading hand in a lot of it. And then on the basis of Colossians, Paul and his team put together Ephesians as a kind of more generalized version of Colossians to go to the churches in Southwestern Asia Minor. So there's different types of authorship going on here. Now you can say Paul is involved in all three of them, whether it's being author, co-author, or kind of like, you know, lead editor. And, you know, because and some of these letters are different in some of the language that we find. But, I mean, for me, if you take a letter like Ephesians, it's dealing with issues that I think were overwhelmingly make sense in the context of Paul's life rather than, you know, 50 or 80 years later. I mean, it strikes me as a Pauline document. The place where we have the biggest problem is with the pastoral epistle, because the pastoral epistles, on the one hand, sound genuinely like Paul, but they also can sound a bit like a second generation eulogizing Paul. And it is a little bit hard track. And I mean, I'll be honest with you. I mean, you can just say, well, Paul just wrote it, but he was in a different mood. Someone else wrote it trying to imitate Paul's style, saying, if Paul was here, what would he say today? Or you could say maybe something else was going on. And my theory my hunch for the pastoral epistles is that these seem to be based on genuine letters and notes of Paul, but someone may have kind of updated them or touched them up a bit or contemporized them, particularly in light of Paul's death. And I think they've probably done that because Paul has passed away and they want to add these final three letters as a kind of capstone to the Pauline letter collection. That's my own theory that explains, because like I said, there's parts of the pastorals that just really do sound normally like Paul, but there's some bits of it where it does sound a bit like a eulogizing or a lionizing of Paul. And we kind of need a bit of a theory that's going to explain that. But if you have a flexible idea of authorship, I think that enables you to explain a wide variety of phenomena that we find in the Pauline letters.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And you're right, it does resolve a lot of the issues that people come up with when they're reading the stories. And that's a huge difference between, you know, what you just described and, you know, someone, whatever, 10 years after Paul is dead, who never met Paul, just writing a letter in his name. That's a real different kind of thing going on.
Yeah, I mean, that's the difference. Someone may, with all good intentions, say, look, if Paul was here today, what would he say? And maybe they're trying to do that. But the thing we have to remember about, again, nearly all of Paul's letters mention co-authors or people who are with him. And you've got to wonder, you know, how much input did Paul get from others in his letters? And so we don't have like a clear, crisp control sample. We can't say, okay, here's one letter that is just by Paul, and this is just him. No Timothy, no Silas, no Sosthenes, no Barnabas. This is just Paul in his own words, you know, unplugged. And then we can compare it with all this other stuff. We don't have a pure control sample. And every letter we have, the impression you get, it's Paul writing his letters in association with some of his co-workers and collaborators. Okay, which means the whole authorship question can become very complex.
It seems very strange to me to make conclusive statements about who wrote a letter about 2,000 years ago, you know? Like, I mean, I think that my writings between when I was, say, 18 and now probably sound very different, and yet I'm the same person. And also, again, just where I am in life and my mood, like the letters are different, and we're not separated by 2,000 years from the stuff that I write too, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and you can see that. You can see that in Paul's letters already. If you look at Paul's tone in Galatians, you know, Paul had not had his morning coffee when he wrote Galatians. He just got out of bed, and you know, he was like a bear with a really bad hangover. You know, he was just angry. So you can picture Paul pacing up and down the room, possibly yelling, as someone's kind of, you know, taking down what he's saying to Galatians. But on the other hand, a Philippian, Paul is kind of like, you know, he's dealing with the one congregation that's not a problem child. I mean, you know, you've got the bad, which is the Galatians, you've got the ugly, which is the Corinthians, but the Philippians were the good. They were the one congregation that were providing help, not headaches. And so you see a completely different mood. But I can say, look, you find this in different authors as well. I mean, if you read Shakespeare, I mean, you read these masterful things like Macbeth and Hamlet, and then you go and read one of his other plays, Titus Andronicus, and it's absolutely awful. And you wonder how could the guy who wrote Hamlet write the drivel of Titus Andronicus? You know, it's just one of those things. Authors can be more flexible and malleable than we recognize.
What about the other letters? Are there letters? Are there epistles? Non-Pauline epistles that most scholars agree probably weren't by the author ascribed to them?
The number one letter that has the largest case against authenticity has to be 2 Peter, for a whole bunch of reasons. 2 Peter seems to, it's aware of the Pauline letter collection, so it's where Paul's letters have already been gathered and collected. It knows of 1 Peter, it seems to incorporate almost the entire epistle of Jude, and it seems to have an allusion to the Matthean version of the Transfiguration story. It's written in very different Greek from 2 Peter. It uses a lot of language that you would more ordinarily find in the 2nd century. Nobody quotes it till like the 3rd century. So 2 Peter is the one text where arguing that Peter wrote it is pushing a steep rock up a big rock up a steep hill. And there's different ways of doing that. Again, you can say, well, authors can just be a little bit more flexible, like I said before. Richard Baucom argues that 2 Peter is what he calls a transparent fiction. He says it was intended to be a kind of, well, if Peter was here today, what would he say? And drawing on different elements of the New Testament as it was kind of circulating, kind of draws a number of themes to a head and offers an exhortation to the readers. So 2 Peter is the one letter that has the hardest time in terms of authenticity. And yeah, I would say the odds are it's very probably not written by Peter himself, but written, like I said, someone trying to imagine if Peter was here today, what would he say to us?
So I think where the next place my mind goes is when the Bible is canonized, did they know that?
Well, there were debates about that. There were debates, and those debates did not go away. Many people did have a lot of questions about 2 Peter. 2 Peter was more popular in the West than it was in the East. And in the Eastern Church, they did kind of, you know, scratch their head about it and go, don't know about this. But because the general consensus in most places that was that it was worthy of inclusion, even if it wasn't written by Peter, it was at least congruent with the rest of the New Testament, and it seemed to embody a type of apostolic testimony.
So in other words, they kind of knew, like they wouldn't, if we could impart that knowledge to them, they wouldn't have said, we shouldn't have included it then in the canon.
Well, some people certainly did not think it was written by Peter, but they were happy to include it anyway. Others, I think there were others who probably generally did think it was written by Peter. So there was a diversity of opinion in the early church on this. And we see the sort of debates, Eusebius record the type of debates that were going on. And for many people, 2 Peter was among the disputed parts of the canon that were included, but people did have some questions and reservations about.
So in other words, for everyone, pseudonymity did not disqualify a letter from being included.
This is a big topic on its own. I think a lot of people would say yes, pseudonymity as forgery. Yeah, I think people would exclude that. And Tertullian gives an example of a presbyter who was forging certain documents in the name of others. But I don't think all forgery, not all pseudonymity was designed to be forgery. And I remember there was one chap, I think in the 5th century, who as a creative exercise wrote some letters from Timothy. And his bishop then kind of, you know, took him up on this, saying, well, you shouldn't have done that. He says, well, you know, it's just, you know, I'm just kind of writing stuff. I thought everyone knew this was. I'm just kind of writing some sort of creative imagination thing. I wasn't saying this was really from Timothy. So you do get things like that going on as well. But even that, as the bishop suggests, has some sort of certain moral problems. But you can find even today people write what you might call fan fiction. When people write their own kind of novel about Jesus and the apostle, even the movie of the apostle Paul or that sort of a thing. People do their own kind of fan fiction, and you could say maybe some of those early letters, although not actually written by certain apostles, were kind of designed as a sort of fan fiction.
So this is a good segue. We're gonna take it up a notch here. Let's get an inspiration and inerrancy and infallibility, because you spend some time in the book talking about those. So for those who don't know, what's the difference between inerrancy and infallibility?
Well, that is very much in the eye of the beholder. There is upteen definitions of inerrancy, upteen definitions of infallibility. Inerrancy is a relatively new word. It didn't really get used till the late 19th century. Normally in the Protestant tradition, they've talked about the sufficiency and the infallibility of scriptures. And if you wanted to be technical, you could say that inerrancy says that the Bible does not err. Infallibility means the Bible cannot err. But for reasons that I find confusing and baffling, certain groups in America think that the word inerrancy is stronger than infallibility. Although this really comes down to the semantics of English, the way people use the word. Inerrancy has been kind of used, certainly in the American context, but other places too, as a kind of circling of the wagons. So to establish Christian belief in the face of modern critiques of revealed religion, they kind of fortify their doctrine of scripture and kind of make that the sort of fortress which they'll never surrender, which has obvious attractions. If you believe in a God who reveals himself, you know, in scripture, who always speaks the truth to his people, it makes a lot of sense to do that. The problem is you can be setting yourself up for a fall if you combine your view of inerrancy with a particular view of interpretation or a certain way of interpretation. And that's where, and this is one of my problems with the American inerrancy tradition, many people proclaim the inerrancy of the text, but what they really mean is, I suspect, the inerrancy of their interpretation. So if you have the wrong interpretation of, say, Genesis 1 or some other passage in the Bible, they will accuse you not of having a bad interpretation, but they'll accuse you of violating the canons of inerrancy, which for me kind of gives the game away that often discussions about inerrancy are not about the inerrancy of the Bible, but they're about other different things going on behind the scenes in Christian circles and the hegemony of certain groups in certain contexts.
Yeah, so this is great. So I was talking recently with someone that I know, and he was asking me about and what I thought about inerrancy. And I said, well, I prefer infallibility. And he said, well, that's not enough for me. You got, and which reflects what you're talking about, the circling of the wagon things. It's kind of like, well, who's on board enough? Let's give them a purity test to see, you know, if they believe in the Bible enough. And I find that most of the time, people who are talking about or who say they believe in inerrancy, what they mean, and this speaks to what you were talking about, their interpretation of interpreting things literal that, in my opinion, were not always meant to be literal. So maybe like a literal 7-day creation. But I feel like those, even aside from the 7th-day creation, the Bible speaks something. Well, for I'll use the example I use. Jesus mentions that the mustard seed is the smallest of all the seeds. Well, it's not. You know, scientifically, it's not. So, if you believe in that brand of inerrancy, I guess that's a huge problem for you.
Exactly. And that's the problem. You come up with such a precise and narrow definition of inerrancy that it falls apart when you come across the first sort of problem or incongruity. I mean, you can also like compare episodes in the Synoptic Gospels. Like, did Jesus heal one blind man in Jericho or two blind men? Did he heal him in the way in or on the way out of town? Now, if I mean, you know, my view is, you know, he healed a blind guy, you know, in the vicinity of Jericho, whether it was one guy or two guys. Matthew loves twos. He just doubles everything, you know. You know, Mark's got one, I'll have two. Two's way more better. And in historical writing at the time, you could be that bit of flexibility. You could have a bit of artistic license in the way you told the story. But for some people, that causes kind of cerebral meltdown. And the danger is you set yourself up for a big fall because you define inerrancy so strictly, you make Christianity rest entirely on your definition of inerrancy. And then when people realize it doesn't work, they can end up not just jettisoning inerrancy, but even jettisoning the whole Christian faith, because they've just been set up for this, you know, incredibly impossible standard that falls apart the minute you start actually reading the Bible or wrestling with it at a deep and profound level. And I don't think that was what the Bible was meant for. It was meant to, you know, to be a guide and lamp to our feet. but it wasn't. It wasn't meant to be this sort of minutia of sort of detail that was meant to be lined up with everything, so there was no messiness. I mean, I think the Bible conveys that the messiness of human existence, of human life, and things don't always, add up. We don't always get closure. Sometimes we have to live with ambiguity, and I think that's part of human existence. And I think the Bible, tells us that's part of life, and we see that, I think, even in the Bible itself.
Yeah, that's a great point. I'm one who is of the opinion that inerrancy kind of suffers the death of a thousand cuts. Once you modify it enough to be true, then that's almost like my definition of infallibility. If you realize that the Bible is not a book of science, it's not concerned about getting the science right, that's not the point. And also that the Bible is not all history by our modern day journalistic standards.
Exactly.
Like you were talking about the, does Jesus help one blind man or two? And you could imagine some eyewitnesses getting some details, some contradicting details, but what they know for sure is that somebody got healed that day or, got their sight exactly. back that day.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few different problems. I mean, a lot of I hear progressive people saying they don't like inerrancy, that they don't even like biblical authority,
Right.
And they say if you make the Bible an authority, you turn the Bible into, I've heard the words, a paper pope. Okay, instead of the guy in the pointy white hat, now you've got the pastor with the black and white pages. And they find that so they want to replace their authority with something else, which is usually their own sort of political persuasion or their own theological ethos then becomes the authority. But then you've got the opposite view that says the Bible is the absolute center of our faith, which I'll be honest with you is borderline bibliolatry. The Bible is not the center of your faith. The Bible tells us that Jesus is the center of our faith. Okay. And, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 3, if you build on any other foundation other than Jesus Christ, I mean, you're setting yourself up for a fall. So the Bible is God's word to us, and we take account of Jesus's own view of Scripture, but it's Jesus, I would say, not the Bible, that is the center of our faith.
Yeah, that's so good. We can elevate the Bible to be a fourth member of the Trinity if we're not careful. Yeah, you mentioned the rule book thing, and it's funny, when people used to say that, I used to say, yeah, I totally agree with that. This is, for one, it's a story, it's a narrative, right? But I think what people mean when they say now that it's not even authoritative, it's not either it's a rule book or it's authoritative, but not both. And so I think that, I think that that's a false dichotomy to say that it's either boiled down to a list of rules or it can't be authoritative.
Yeah, I mean, if you treat the Bible as a rule book, that really is an impoverished view of it, because it's so much more. It's not there just to give us rules of do's and don'ts. It's there to inspire us. It's there to give us hope. It's there to tell us of a God who loves us to the point that he gave his own son, who bore our sins in our place and was raised to put us right with him. So, yeah, I'm definitely not a big fan of the sort of rule book view of the Bible, because the Bible is more that. It's poetry. It's narrative. It's apocalypse. It's exhortation. It's consolation. It's so much more than rules.
So, but let's talk about how then it is authoritative, because that's tricky. I think that's one of a chapter in N.T. Wright's book, The Last Word, where he asks the question, how can a narrative be authoritative? Which is a really good question, a really good way to phrase that. Another thing that complicates this, we talked about canon earlier. We've got Protestants, Catholics, and Orthodox churches. We've all got different Bibles. We don't talk about that much. Are we just hoping we got our Bible right, Mike? Like, what? How do we do with this? Deal with this, and how can it be authoritative?
Well, on the canon question, I would say our Bibles are fundamentally the same. There's just a few differences around the edges and in some of the terminology we use to describe it. So, for instance, let's take the Protestant Bible, where you've got the books of the Old Testament and the New Testament. I mean, they're affirmed by all Protestants, Catholics, Orthodox as well. You've then got what's called the Apocrypha or the Deuterocanonicals. Now, Protestants have traditionally affirmed them. And even if they weren't part of the official teaching of Churchill for the formation of doctrine, they were always considered useful. The King James Bible was printed with the Apocrypha up until the 1880s in America, where the American Bible Society stopped printing the Apocrypha, mainly because of anti-Catholic prejudice. So they kind of took the Apocrypha out of the King James Bible as a kind of backhanded attack on the Catholics. But generally, Protestants have always regarded the Apocrypha as having a certain kind of utility, even if it wasn't useful in the formation of doctrine. And the same thing goes with the Orthodox Church. I mean, they're different. They don't have like Old and New Testament or Apocrypha. They just call it the books to be read. So they've just got like the one category, the anagnoskomena, the things to be read, which is, the books of their Bible. So, we can talk a little bit of a difference in terminology and the status of the Apocrypha and that kind of thing. But generally speaking, there is consensus, even a unanimous feeling across the tradition about the main books that make up our Bible. So that's the canon question. What was the other thing, Shane, on top of that? That was the second thing.
Well, if we say they are authoritative...
Yeah, it means what you say by authoritative. Now, I don't think the Bible should be authoritative for the practice of neurobiology. I'm very happy for my pastor to use the Bible talking about spiritual, theological matters, even ethics. But you have to say authoritative where, in what context, and how. Now, in some senses, I would say the Bible is not authoritative. For example, If you go back and read the stories of war, warfare between the Israelites and the various Canaanite tribes, and here you have Bronze Age texts, a sort of tribal world, no concept of human rights, and wars are fought with a certain level of viciousness and barbarity. How do the people of God survive in that context? Well, we kind of find out how God leads the people through that context. And it, not because like this is the best way to conduct a war. This is good. This is how it should be. It's like, okay, this is a dire and terrible situation, and this is how you make the best of it. And in some cases, it's more of like this is the least worst option rather than the ideal for what it should be for all the ages. Okay, so I would not be conducting warfare today on the basis of the Old Testament, intertribal warfare stories. I think we do have something much better, the way our civilization has developed on the basis of its Christian principles, to believe that even if you do have to conduct warfare, there are more humane ways of doing it, that recognizing human beings are in the image of God, and we should always, try to be peacemakers and that type of thing. But I would say the Bible is authoritative principally in the matters towards which it speaks, which is the nature of Christian faith and living the Christian life. And we need to make sure that remains the authority, because if it's not, then something else will fill the gap. And more often than not, it will become either our own prejudices, our own presuppositions, or more often than not, our own politics. And one thing I've noticed more so in the last 20 years, rather than want to follow the moral vision of the Bible, people just want to use the Bible as capital for their own political vision. And I mean, you can see this in all sorts of different ways. The way people from ranging from Planned Parenthood to the NRA quote the Bible, Democrats or Republicans, people don't so much want to listen to the Bible, be challenged it, or put into practice as much as use the Bible to justify their own political ends. And that, I think, is the actual opposite of biblical authority. Rather than trying to allow its worldview and teachings infuse you and challenge you and shape you, and influence the way you live your life, you're just ripping verses here and there, taking things out of context, and just trying to justify what you've already decided for a whole bunch of other reasons.
So I'm glad you said that. The one passage that I wanted to read straight from the book, this is from the chapter called Scripture's Normative, Not Negotiable. So you're talking here about progressives, and you say, strangely enough, the bits of the Bible that come from God just so happen to conform to politically progressive views on climate change, immigration, socialism, gender fluidity, healthcare, abortion, religious freedom, education, geopolitical views of the EU and UN, and military expenditure. What an amazing coincidence. So I think that... I'm sensing what's happening here is probably a difference in context between Australia and America, where we are still kind of just coming out of Christendom. So all of those things could also have been said for conservatives, like you just said.
Exactly.
So why in the book pick on the progressives is my question.
Well, because they're also the ones who can, you know, use and abuse the ballot. In that context, I was referring to some tweets by Union Seminary.
Yeah.
Where I mean, the stuff they were tweeting was just hilarious. It was like a 23-year-old seminary grad with a neck tattoo and an addiction to tofu was basically just spurting out all these ridiculous aphorisms about the Bible. You know, like once you take out all the heteronormativity and the patriarchy, the Bible's not too bad. It was sort of weird stuff like that. So that's why I was picking on them. But, you know, the same thing happens to those of a different political persuasion. You can end up with people just want to pick and choose the bits of the Bible that resonates with their politics, or they engage in a whole-scale reinterpretation of the Bible to fit with their sort of, you know, political scheme. And that's always dangerous when you do that. Rather than use the Bible as capital for your political ventures, we need to do a better job at making the Bible something that influences our politics. And more often than that, I like to think that will mean, you know, breaking the binaries that you find in various places around the world. And this is, you know, in my mind, why I personally don't fit into the American political binary. I mean, on certain issues, I think of, say, you know, things like, shall we say, I mean, it's delicate and needs to be passed out, but things like abortion or marriage, I would be, you might call me a social conservative, but, you know, I also believe in gun control and free healthcare. You know, I just, for me, those things are somewhat self-evident as a Christian, but they're certainly not self-evident for many of my American Christian friends. And that's where we all have to ask, well, what's shaping us? Are we being shaped by the Bible, or are we being shaped by cultural forces around us to the expense of the Bible? And are we, you know, at risk of distorting the Bible to make it say things that it doesn't really say, or intend things that's more like what we want than what God wants?
Yeah. And I would affirm, I also don't fit in the binary, but what I think what I would say is, as an American who just came out of 4 years of Trump presidency, I don't know that both sides are equally wrong. I think that looking at climate change. Boy, if there's ever something that's justifiable, or we could justifiably worry about, I think it's climate change. And boy, Christians in the United States, by and large, don't get that. Don't see why Christians should care about that at all. We, again, just after the last 4 years, and our immigration policy was so inhumane and so unjust. I look at my progressive friends and I think if you're wrong about immigration, you're not as equally wrong as the conservatives have been for the past 4 years. So yeah, I'm with you with the binary there.
Yeah, on the climate change thing, if there's any Christians out there listening and they have climate change skepticism, I really recommend Catherine Hayhoe, who's an evangelical Christian lady, but also one of the leading scientists on climate change. So if there are any climate change skeptics out there, I really, really do ask you to consult Catherine Hayhoe.
That's awesome. I haven't read any of hers, but I've heard a few interviews of hers as well. So what do we do with the problem texts? The texts, you know, some things, especially in the Old Testament, where you talk about slavery, Paul doesn't seem to condemn it in Philemon, which can be kind of distressing. There's some things that are said about women that are distressing. What do we do with these?
Well, the first thing you have to recognize is that these are products of their own time, which is different from our time. And you have to respect the difference and recognize that values change. Now, we see this like in our own time. Take the TV show, the sitcom. They've taken out the character Apu because they don't want a white guy pretending to be an Indian guy. That's now considered, cultural appropriation, inappropriate, you know, that kind of a thing. Or even the way people want to cancel some older TV shows, like even Friends back in the 1990s by today's standard, it's considered out of sync with some of the values we have today. So we've got to recognize that people in, you know, in a previous generation, let alone, you know, millennia ago, did not share our own view of humanity, equality, rights, and that kind of thing. And, you know, look, two or three generations from now, maybe people will condemn us for all sorts of reasons. So you simply got to recognize that it was a different time and people were doing what they thought was right in light of what they knew. And God is speaking to people in that context, okay? You know, he's speaking to people where they are at, not saying, of course, people need to be taught how to behave as if it's 2020 or 2035 or 2045. I mean, there's never going to be a period of human history where we finally achieved kind of pure, complete, utter human justice, okay? Every age is going to have its own triumphs and its own moral failures. And God speaks to people where they are. Now, yeah, part of me says, I wish that Paul went to Rome with a sign saying hashtag slave lives matter. But that was not number one on the agenda at the time. I mean, Paul says things about slavery, which I think when prosecuted would eventually lead to the abolishment of slavery, particularly what he says to Philemon. Of course, you know, but for Paul and for many others, slavery, as terrible as it was also the only welfare system they had. I mean, if you reached poverty, your choice was banditry, begging, prostitution, or slavery. Okay, that was pretty much the only option for a lot of places. And in that context, well, you know, how should you treat slaves? You know, that does come up. So I would say Paul was no William Wilberforce, but without someone like Paul and the Christian tradition, we would never have had William Wilberforce and the abolition of slavery.
So somebody might say, okay, fair enough, it was a different time, but you're also not telling me that The Simpsons or Friends should be authoritative in my life as well, right? So how do we know for the things that, there are some things that Paul and the other writers, let's stick with the New Testament, that they tell us that are really hard, that are hard for us in culture. So are we saying, well, that was for them, we're beyond that now?
In some cases, yes. Let's take the household codes that you find in Colossians 3, Ephesians 5, I think, and in 1 Peter. Basically, Christian authors were taking a sort of standard Greek and Roman way of running a household where you have like the pater familias, the man, the wife, children, slaves, a kind of a genuine hierarchy, and saying, look, and this is how you run a house. And Christians are doing one of two things simultaneously. On the one hand, they want to show that they have a sense of decorum and order and responsibility, okay? And on the other hand, sometimes they tend to act a little bit more subversively or go against the cultural grain, okay? So they seem to be doing both things simultaneously, okay? So they do repeat what we would call very standard Greco-Roman mores about how to run a household. They do add some very distinct Christian glosses, particularly, you know, in the treatment of slaves and talking about mutual submission. Okay, so they're even, if you like, replying a kind of redemptive ethic or a divine perspective to pre-existing pagan ethical norm, okay, but they're taking them over. Now, that was expedient because of the context they were in, okay? It was expedient. It doesn't necessarily mean it was ideal. And when I'm teaching on the household codes, this is the analogy I give. I say, look, I've got my boss, you know, Brian Rosner, great New Testament scholar in his own rank, and I say, you know, wouldn't it be good if we could form an alliance between the House of Bird and the House of Rosner? So how about we propose a deal where I get my daughter, Alyssa, to marry Brian's son, Toby. We'll just make this an arranged marriage. They'll come together. We'll create this massive alliance between these two houses. And together, the House of Rosner and Bird, through this marriage alliance, we will dominate the evangelical Anglican scene in Melbourne. Now, in the ancient world, that's kind of what they did. You know, I suggested this idea to my daughter, Alyssa. And her response was like, oh no, you're not. I'm doing that. I mean, so that's what they did back then. It was expedient, but it was not necessarily ideal. And we can still extrapolate principles which do apply. Like, I think mutual submission can apply in any context. Children will always be dependent upon their parents to certain degrees. Therefore, obeying them is a very, very good idea. I mean, I still quote Ephesians 6 to my kids all the time. You know, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right, and it'll sort of go well for you. There are principles we can take away, but I'll be perfectly honest with you. I would not be running my home as if I'm, adopting a household code in like first century Corinth, because the context is different. The wider public norms are different, and it would be very difficult to live a 21st century house in the way that you run a first century Corinthian villa. That's not to say there's nothing there we can't learn and apply, but you've got to apply some transcultural and some historical interpretation to see what applies and is relevant to you.
So let's talk about Jesus. How do we read? I love the section where you talk about the Jesus Storybook Bible. I was reading that and I'm like, I think we have one of those somewhere. And I found it in my kids' room. And I'm like, yeah, that is good. You bring that up in the book because, now, I can't remember the author's name of the Jesus Storybook Bible, but
I think it's Sally Lloyd Jones.
Yeah. So it's a children's Bible, and she does a great job of taking biblical stories and centering them around Jesus, and use that as kind of a illustration of what we should do when we're reading the Bible. What's it look like? What's a Jesus lens hermeneutic for reading the Bible?
That is to say, when we read the Old Testament, we've got to be conscious of another story that is coming. That is the story of Jesus. And we've got to think, how does the story I'm reading the Old Testament, how does it relate to, how does it prepare for, or how does it remind me of Jesus? Okay. You don't want to do this in a real cheesy fashion, as if you have to cringingly Jesusify literally everything you read. I mean, you can read the Old Testament on its own terms and its own right. But to read it as a Christian, the way the apostles did, to read it even the way Jesus suggested we should read the Old Testament, is it does have a kind of testimonial function in kind of pointing ahead to him. And I think that's something that's very useful to do when you're reading the Old Testament stories from, Genesis to the prophets, and especially in the Psalms.
Well, I really, really enjoyed the book, and it was a really, it was a fun read, and it's really accessible to people too. I'm excited for people to get their hands on it. Have you by chance, have you ever ventured to TikTok? Do you know what that is?
No, I know of it. I know it, but I'm very reluctant to give the Chinese government all of my online digital details.
That's fair. Every detail about my life is out there for any nefarious government. So I'm already there. I spend way too much time on it. I don't create things, but I watch. Here's what I'm getting at. It is a cesspool of amateur Bible scholars on TikTok. And the stuff that they are saying and the way that they are sounding like they are an authority on this is terrifying. So I think this is a great book for the TikTok generation is what I'm getting at. I think this is a great, great corrective.
Well, I'm glad. That is probably one of the best compliments I think I've ever received, Shane.
On a reprint, if you want a quote, hit me up, okay?
Okay, I'll keep that in mind. This book is for the TikTok generation.
TikTok generation.
It's a little bit better than saying this book is for the disco generation.
That's right. Well, Mike, thanks so much for being on the show.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, Shane. And thank you for listening to all of your listeners out there.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, Have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have, and I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org, and you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at Beard on a Bike. That's at Beard on a Bike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. But